6 months from now, you could be running a 5K, booking that dream trip, or seeing thicker, fuller hair every time you look in the mirror. Through Hers, you can get dermatologist-trusted, clinically proven prescriptions with ingredients that go beyond what over-the-counter products offer. Whether you prefer oral or topical treatments, Hers has you covered. Getting started is simple. Just fill out an intake form online, and a licensed provider will recommend a customized plan just for you. The best part? Everything is 100% online. If prescribed, your treatment ships right to your door. No pharmacy trips, no waiting rooms, and no insurance headaches. Plus, treatments start at just $35 a month. Start your initial free online visit today at forhers.com/talk. That's forhers.com/talk. Compounded products are not FDA approved or verified for safety, effectiveness, or quality. Prescription required. Price varies based on product and subscription plan. See website for full details, restrictions, and important safety information.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
Alrighty, welcome to the Dear Son Show, where we have meaningful conversations about life through the lens of fatherhood. It's for fathers, those with fathers, and the fatherless, so nobody's left out. These are the conversations I want my sons to access as they grow through life in the manhood, so no topics off limits. I'm your host tonight, D. Johns. Jay Black is out, but we got an amazing guest, somebody that I ran into producing another podcast, and he's so graciously favored us with his presence. Joe T. Baker III, welcome to the show, my brother. How are you?
I'm great, man. What about yourself, bro?
I'm doing well, man. I'm doing very well. I'm excited to get into your story. We met through Nate. I'm calling Nate out. Got to call Nate out because you asked me about what he's doing his podcast. So y'all get in the comments and tag from Nate with love because he has a gift. He has it in his head what he needs to do, and we need him to do.
Thanks.
The people need to hear it. So yeah, man, welcome to the show, man. Let's get right into it.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
Film the episode, man, and just hearing your story and just the brief conversation that we did have, you were just genuine, man. And I waited as long as I could to see if you would be willing to make that trek, what I thought was a trek back over here, but you are closer to where I am now. So I appreciate you. Appreciate you accepting the offer. And I'm looking forward to this conversation because there are things that I know and there are things that I assume based on what I've seen.
That's real.
So let's give the people a little bit of the background, as much as you want, including your social media presence, but from earliest days, where you from?
I guess I just want to start with saying, you know, in and out of trouble pretty much my whole life. Mm-hmm. Started at age 13, 14, all the way up till I was 18 years old, where I ended up getting a 10-year sentence and going to prison.
Ooh.
And doing the whole 10 years. And while I was there, of course, I did time in the cell with my biological brother, same mama, same daddy. Left that prison, went to another prison where me and my daddy shared a cell. Left that prison because me and my daddy was selling dope together, doing a lot of stuff we ain't had no business doing. Of course, I got engaged to a correction officer at the time. The institution found out about me being engaged to the correction officer, split me and my daddy up, sent him to one prison, sent me to another. And then when I got to that prison, my daddy's brother there, who's my uncle, who doing 75 years. And I had like a year and a half, 2 years left, and then came home. My last 2 years, went up for parole. They denied me, told me to do the rest. And at that point, I felt the tug on my heart. And I was like, man, I got to get myself together. Jumped in that word and came home 2 years after that. And here we are today.
So you already ran through some of my assumptions. I knew about your daddy, but brother, daddy, uncle, in that order, meeting your blood in a place of... I don't even know how to describe it.
Confinement.
I guess that's accurate. I mean, you flew through some stuff.
Yeah.
You flew through some stuff. How do you actually get in the game? Because you said you and your dad sold drugs. Was that in jail that y'all were doing, running it from the jail?
Yeah.
Like, how did you get into the game?
It actually started before I got to the prison. Because my brother, when he first basically got into the streets and got into selling drugs and stuff. It was connected to my daddy. My daddy was a gangster disciple. He was GD. So he still had a lot of connections on the streets. And he plugged in my brother.
Yeah.
And me seeing what my brother had going on, of course, I'm thinking, because he never broke bread with me, which was also a reason me and him had a wedge, because I'm your little brother. You break bread with everybody else, but you don't break bread with me. So at that point, I'm telling my dad, hey, man, you need to plug me in too.
Yeah.
So of course, he plugged me in from the pen.
Wow.
With somebody, you know, which was, I was already kind of in the streets, just wild, but that really, that's where the drugs and all of that stuff came in.
So what, at what point, how long was your father in your life outside of prison?
None. My dad.
None, the whole time.
Yeah, my dad, I just turned 37. My dad has been locked up, I want to say 35, going on 36. Yeah, I think I was maybe 2-3 months old. Yeah, because it's only one memory he remember of holding me. I laid on his chest, and then after that, yeah, he's my whole entire life.
Wow.
Yeah.
So is he, you say you're from Memphis?
Springfield, Tennessee.
Springfield, Tennessee.
We're 30 minutes from Nashville, from, 3 hours from Memphis.
3 hours from Memphis.
I did a lot of time in Memphis, though.
Okay. Yeah. Maybe I heard that story before.
I did a lot of my time in Memphis.
Which is that where your dad is from, or how much do you know about his history?
My dad, Springfield, he from Springfield. My dad went to the military. I ain't sure what parts he went to as far as overseas, but I know he ended up landing in Clarkville, Tennessee, where I was born, Fort Campbell Base.
Okay.
And then from there, I think that's where everything kind of spun out of control. My mom said when he came back from the military, he wasn't the same.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, any exposure overseas or to war-torn areas, yeah. I wasn't in the military, but I was a military contractor.
Yeah.
And I wasn't the same when I came back. I just went to Iraq for a year thinking I was doing it for my family. Financially, it helped, but it was some things I had to recover from. Just being away, being in the war zone. And the mindset you have to have to keep sane.
Right.
Really. Well, yeah. The mindset I chose to have, I can't speak for everybody.
You actually just described something similar when you walk out of prison. Literally.
We'll get to that. I kind of want to stay in your childhood because your dad wasn't there. Right. Who are your older brother? Is it just an older brother?
Yeah. I got an older brother, 3 years older than me, and then my sister, 5 years younger than me.
So what was his influence on your life? As you were growing up, or was he?
My brother?
Yeah.
My brother was he most definitely was somebody I looked up to. He was kind of like my hero, especially when it came to basketball. We share the same love for that basketball. If I hear a ball dribbling right now, I got to see where it's coming from.
Say word.
Yeah, my brother. Yeah, I got it. I seen the look in your eye. If I'll do it to you.
No you probably would. We ain't gonna turn the cameras on the first time.
Yeah. My brother, man, I used to watch him pat that ball, man, and he could literally start from one end of the street and walk all the way up to the other end of the street just going through his legs. And that inspired me to play ball, man. And so, especially when it came to that, my brother was very fashionable. Dressed, you know. I feel like still now when I'm looking at my closet, I see a lot of clothes and I just can't mix and match it sometimes. Yeah. My brother used to
put that thing.
Yeah. He kept his clothes. He'd go to the cleaners, real respectful to women. I remember a time we got into it because I was disrespectful to this girl. He was like, bro, don't do that. My brother was smart, did great in school as far as grades, homecoming, prom, all of that. Like my brother was.
He was the guy.
Until the plug happened. Yeah, but yeah. My brother was most definitely, very likable. A lot of people love my brother, man, to this day. My brother was special. My brother was special.
I want you to hear this question for what it is, not for anything else. Did you know to miss your father when you were young?
I didn't.
Okay.
I didn't. I think it started hitting me when my granddaddy died. Even though I didn't spend as much time with him, but when I was around or saw my granddad, it was almost like, I guess, that I didn't have from my pops. And, you know, the guy that my mama dated at the time, which is my sister's father, he played a pretty solid role. Like he was there. Even though he was in the streets, he was there. So now I didn't know. I guess it's true. You don't know to miss something that you never had. Yeah.
So what was life like in Springfield And we don't have to start earliest days, but like, what was the, do you remember when the streets became more appealing than maybe basketball or whatever?
Early.
Okay.
Let's talk early, about it. Early. I was in love with that basketball. I'm 13, 14. The streets, I'll say 11, 12, 13, somewhere in there, it was already becoming that. And I think that stemmed from my mama's boyfriend, my sister's daddy. Mm. Like, he was heavy in the streets as far. But I can come home from riding my bike or playing basketball somewhere. We come in. Well, coming down the street, you already going to see all the dope boys, their cars lined up because they at the house. Like, big dice games. Come in, you seeing walls of money. You know, they shaking the dice. They got their little thing where they blowing the dice. And my sister daddy had a superstition where he ain't like you crossing over his legs. Like, he'll make you cross back over his legs backwards. That stuff right there was already appealing. Like, that was when the big herringbone chains and, you know, the rims, the Vols, the Daytons.
Yeah.
You know, they putting the chrome caps or with an air going the tire.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, all of that stuff STEM became caps. Appealing. Listening to the lingo and then not knowing what drugs was at the time. I can remember coming home and somebody had broken our house. This happened twice. Mm. And I remember walking in the pantry one day and seeing drugs. I didn't know what it exactly. I just knew everything was bagged up.
Yeah.
And later on, seeing what it was, I started connecting the two. And then I started connecting. That's where the money coming from. You know what I'm saying? Same thing kind of happened with affiliation when it come to my daddy,
yep.
Which became appealing to me at a young age because going to visit, he had a pitchfork kind of seared in between his hand right here. And I always wondered, like, what that was. Because he never told me.
Okay.
And I went, when I got locked up the first time in juvie, I started seeing people throwing up the sign and then I connected the two. So this kind of, it happened kind of early. Yeah. Yeah. 11, 12, 13 was wondering like, yeah.
Dope boy era, dice games at the house,
mm-hmm.
drugs in the pantry. You connected the dots.
Mm-hmm.
How easy was it for you to get put on?
Through my daddy, it was pretty easy, but I started stealing drugs from my brother before that happened. That's kind of how we started really bumping heads. He caught me.
Gotcha.
Because his name was ringing so much. Sometimes when people couldn't get a hold of him, they would see me. I mean, like, man, I've been trying to call your brother. I don't even know how to weigh things at the time.
Gotcha.
I don't know what a ball is, 3.5 and quarters and halves and holes and zips and out. I'm literally learning this by people saying, man, I've been trying to call your brother, get an ounce, man. He ain't out on the phone. Can you grab it for me? I would just
grab something.
Grab it. And it happened one time, man, and
it was discounting.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It was 3-4 people who I hit I got a nice little roll.
Yeah.
And where he had the drugs at the time, it was a lady house, man. I guess about a third or fourth time I was running in and out, she actually called and said, you been sending boo over here? Because what they called me. You been sending boo? And he was like, nah. And he went and checked. And he called me. And he went off. And he told me, he said, man, bring me my money. And when he told me that, when I took it to him, he didn't give me no cut. No nothing. Like, he was like, man, stay out of my stuff. And I'm like, bro. Like, he fresh head to toe, 3-4 cars.
Yeah.
Got the city on lock, won't give me nothing. So at that point, that's when I started complaining to daddy, like, hey, I didn't kind of learn the game at that point, and he did it. And my daddy say he did that because he felt like if he didn't, I was going to go find it anyway.
Yeah.
Yeah.
When did the game go negative for you? Cause it sounded like it started off fun. I don't know if you was delivering the right quantities or
no, not at all.
He was
not at all. Somebody say they want a 4.5. I was giving them nines. I was giving them quarter birds stuff out of my brother closet.
He love you.
But yeah, the game went south when before I started selling dope, I had hit a couple of licks. I was robbing like people that was connected to my brother and stuff that my homeboys was around. Like, man, I'm telling you, he keeping. And we was kicking in doors, so by the time I'm guessing in my mind, I'm thinking I'm transitioning out of that because now I'm selling dope. I was mixing the two. I'm selling dope and robbing. So a lot of tension. I noticed a lot of tension. And at that point, police started getting involved and just going way too far, as if in your mental you thinking you kind of untouchable because you've just been getting away with it.
Yeah.
And yeah, that's when it started kind of going left. And yeah.
So did people, were you known for that? Like for jacking?
Yeah, I was more so known for that more than the selling dope. My brother was more like the dope man. But yeah, so yeah, my name was, it was horrible on the because of that.
Yeah. So what kind of attention did that bring to you from the streets? Because if you're doing both now, I mean, now you got, I don't know if it's the same enemy, but mm-hmm. if you're jacking people, you know, some people looking for their get back. Now you're getting money.
For sure.
Yeah.
It's kind of weird because a lot of people were still, I think some people were trying to be cool by still shopping with me more so than almost keep your friends closer and enemies closer.
Yeah.
Like I'd rather come off as cool versus I ain't buying dope from him. He might. And then, but it still made it awkward.
Yeah.
And once I started really selling dope, it also caused some conflict with me and my brother.
You were competition?
Because we were serving the same people sometimes.
Competition?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And a lot of times when my brother front, he more kind than me. And when I'm fronting, you got a certain time. And we bumped heads a couple of times because I was going and knocking on dude's door like, hey. And they would call him. And I'd be like, we calling him for what? I'm thinking they. And then I was finding out that, hold on, we fronting.
Same front
the same people. And they thinking, for some of them thought it was his dope. So they thinking they calling, telling him, no, that's mine. Like, and we was kind of bumping heads. So me and my brother had a very weird relationship on the strip of that other than when he needed me to be his muscle. Because he really wasn't street. He was just plugged in.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
Gotcha. Is he still alive today?
Say it again. Yeah. Bro, still alive. Yeah.
What's the relationship with him like today?
It's not too good. My brother's, he homeless. Yeah, my brother, I don't know if it started with him smoking weed. And because we never done drugs. Like, I've never done a drug a day in my life. Like, I never drank anything. Growing up, never. Like, in all of these stories, if people read the book, like, I was never high, never intoxicated my entire life.
Right.
My brother, once he started smoking weed, I don't know if that just kind of opened him up. And then he ran through his money. He started what they call putting one on two, turning one brick into two. Dope bad. That started going south. He started going broke. And I don't know what happened from there. Mm. And it just went completely downhill. I could literally go into my brother's bed, lift up the mattress and see $125,000, $150,000. And it went from that to him coming and getting in the car one day, just riding around. First time he ever let me drive the SS Impala. And I'm telling, because he quiet the whole time, he's smoking weed. I'm like, bro, I'm finna just go home. And when I parked the car, he punched the dashboard and looked at me. He was like, I said, man, what's wrong? He said, bro, I ain't got number 10,000. My eyes was, I was like, how? You got a $10,000 chain on. Like, you got, like, what? Like, and I couldn't comprehend it. Even to this day, seeing his situation, the only thing I can think of is losing all that money just really drove him crazy.
Ooh.
He never could bounce back mentally. Like, I guess shame, embarrassment. You're trying to hide it, like the streets will do you bad.
Streets
will do you bad. And then on top of that, realizing that all these people you done showed all this love to and helped, all these families you done helped feed, even though it was on, that ain't straight. Point blank period, I don't condone that. If you live in that life, it's no such thing as a balance of, well, I'm doing this to feed my family because you destroying and killing others. So I don't believe in a balance of that, speaking in the context of where we were mentally then.
Mm-hmm.
Realizing that everybody else moved on with their life, moved on to the next plug, didn't care to help you. And then if you do start getting high, they don't mind serving you. Money is money. So yeah, me and my brother, man, it's up and down, man, and he ain't in the right state of mind. Like one day he might call me and be talking with 6 cents. The next minute I answer the phone, he going off, cussing me out. So yeah, it's a tough one.
So how did you end up in jail the first time, right? Because it's been a couple stints.
Yeah. I was in and out of juvie 3 times before jail and then before
prison.
Jail and then prison.
Gotcha.
So if the juvie, first time we broke in somebody's house. Second time I was stealing cars. Third time was an attempted murder. Mm. But in the attempted murder, I was still 17, but I was going to juvie until I turned 18. They bound me over to jail. And then I did a year on the nose for that. That was November 16, 2005. I got out November 16 for exactly a year, 2006. I stayed out until July 27, 2007, where it was a murder, kidnapping, and a robbery charge that sent me to prison and on the 10 years. Yeah.
How do you get to a, and again, I'm asking a specific way, so just hear it for what it is.
Mm-hmm.
How do you get to a place where that's normalized? Because even, I know you're reflecting now, you're mm-hmm. not condoning it now.
For sure.
But there's a tone of, like, this was the environment, kind of, is what I'm reading. If I'm reading into it too much,
mm-mm.
back me off.
But, you're exactly right. Normalizing that life?
Yeah. Because you said attempt murder twice.
Yeah. Yeah.
Kidnapping. Yeah.
On top of all the stuff we got away with.
That part.
So, man, when I first came home, bro, I went and spoke at a lot of churches. And I remember this pastor saying to me one time, he said one of his church members asked him, how was I sharing my testimony to that extent without breaking down?
Mm.
And one of the parts of the testimony I always said, but even when I said it, because I'm conscious of it now, I really did not realize it then. I thought everybody was living that way, bro. That's how I normalized it. I thought that was the way of life.
Mm.
Having the life that I have now, having an honest living, seeing, being around people that I clearly get to see who make an honest living, who genuinely care for people.
Yeah.
I had a hard time even watching people love on people. Sometimes I'm like, that's fake. That's fake as ever. Like, something is. It took me a long time to understand that, bro. When I first got to Dallas, I remember seeing a black couple, two of them. Early morning, I'm on my balcony. They were walking their dogs together, girl dog, boy dog. He walking a girl, she walking a boy, and I'm watching. And my friend said, "Well, they corny as ever." I had to reel it in, like, it's pretty dope, because you don't see that. They were holding hands too. That was fresh to me. I'm like, we don't hold hands. And then I seen another couple at the pool one day, in the pool together. He threw the girl up. She came down. He kissed her. And in my mind, I'm thinking all kinds of craziness. I couldn't, because my normal life back home, you just can't convince me that people genuinely care or not robbing, not selling dope, not taking advantage of people, not getting, I just felt like that's just what it was.
Wow.
Literally. All my friends, I go to their house, everybody, something. There's an angle to everything. Like when I say in my videos, telling prison story, penitentiary rules in effect. Everybody has an agenda. Everything is transactional to that extent. So, bro, when I came conscious in that cell, 2010, I'm talking about I cried like a baby because I could not believe. I was so hurt, angry, confused, and frustrated at myself, and I wanted to blame God because I felt like I had literally been tricked out of my life because I thought this was the way. Now I'm sitting here facing a life sentence for something that was pure deception and a mirage. I couldn't believe it. My whole reality was crashing. I couldn't believe it.
So let's walk through. So you went back in 2007.
Mm-hmm.
You said you had the revelation somewhere in 2010. How do you actually get through your prison sentence?
You ain't got a choice first. It took me 2-3 years to accept that. Because with me, I did my prison sentence backwards. And I say that because normally when people go to prison, they go from the county jail, classification, general population. I went backwards. I went maximum security, which is 23-1. I sit on for 2 years and some change. I leave close security, go to classification, and because my points were so high, because of the escape charge, I went to what they call close security, which is really 23-1 or 22-2. I sit back there another 6-7 months. So I spent almost 3 years in isolation to myself. Mentally, I was thrown off. And then at some point, I'm trying to play crazy. As you can see, them cuts on my wrist. So I was taking psychotropic medication during my case. So by the time I come off of max close and into general population, how to survive that was just trauma on top of trauma. I had compounded it to the point where I had to catch my, because I was shaking. Even the dominoes, the loud noise, the cars, and the fast movement. I was sitting in the cell by myself for almost 3 years. You just put me out of here and it's just... So I literally had to go and talk to somebody in prison, almost like a therapist. And I had to explain like what was going on because I wasn't myself. I knew who I was around. I was around people who basically thought similar to me, but I just wasn't the same. And I remember that therapist told me, they said, whatever you do, just don't quit talking, which to me is the best advice I've ever had in my entire life. Without even, because we had a deeper instance conversation, but when they said that, I knew what it meant, and I've been doing it ever since. Vulnerability, saying what's really going on in my mental, what's really going on in my spirit, getting it out, facing it head on, not trying to suppress it down all the time and just work through it. Like, I found people that I could call and talk to and really express what I'm dealing with in prison. And then the survival also came with becoming affiliated, not more so for a sense of protection, but it brought family.
Brotherhood.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, my daddy was there. So have a level of respect and a foundation without having to earn it. That's, you know, so that.
When you had to go talk to somebody, did you feel like you were more a threat to your environment or your environment was more a threat to you?
Both. Both. I don't even know how to explain it. The environment is most definitely a threat to you, point blank, in prison, because everybody on 10, everybody, nothing's free in the penitentiary. A conversation ain't even free. It's coming back around. And having to adjust that your street credibility don't matter. What you think and your status, what you think and your bones you done laid, or if you done did this and you done did that, that don't matter in the penitentiary. When you get there, me really realizing I come from a small town. A lot of people from small town, they have what they call small town syndrome. You'll go to other places and you'll realize that little small gossip y'all think something, that little small stuff y'all doing ain't nothing compared to the city. When you walk in the penitentiary and you start seeing who the heavy hitters are and what's going on and learning the history and what they done, you realize none of them don't even, like, you literally have to start over and lay your bones to get that kind of respect. I'll tell you what really helped me adjust in prison, that basketball. It saved me everywhere I went. Jail, juvie. When I went on the court I was always kind of like, man, that dude cool, man, ain't he balling? That ball kind of saved me a lot. The basketball, and then, of course, I was still selling dope in prison. So everybody, what they call the move. So not that I paid my way, but if you that dude, you kind of, so, yeah.
So your dad was in that prison. He was a gym pop?
Yeah.
What, did he know you were there the whole time, even when you were in 23-1?
I knew I was on my way.
Okay.
Yeah. We used to write back and forth and stuff. Yeah. So he knew I was on the way. He actually got me moved to the prison. When I got off of close, I initially went to the worst prison in the state, which is called Northwest. He knew the warden at the time at Turner Center because the guy who had became the warden used to be an officer. And if I ain't mistaken, he used to deal with my daddy. And then once he became a warden, my daddy kind of hollered at him. It was kind of like a favor.
Yeah.
And he got me moved down there. Yep.
What was it like establishing a relationship with your dad under those circumstances?
Bro, initially, I wanted to hurt him. I wanted to do something to him because I ain't said this part. When I got to that prison, me, my brother, and my daddy was there. When I first got to Turner Center, my brother was already there because he had got him moved because him and my brother was at the same prison together, which is called, it used to be called Brushy Mountain, but they moved my daddy because it was a big tobacco bust. If I'm remembering right, they moved my daddy first. My daddy got my brother moved down there to him at Turner Center. I come off of Max, go to clarification, come off of, I'm on close at another prison. He got me moved there as well. So when I'm coming out of close, my daddy had just got in trouble. They had literally just got busted with, well, his name was attached to it. He didn't get caught. A bunch of tobacco, heroin, phones, all kind of stuff. He was running to prison. So when I'm getting off of close, he in the hole. I'm going to the compound, really kind of spooked, and I'm, because now he ain't there.
Yeah.
So I'm literally finna have to find my way. And I already felt what I probably done felt my whole life. Dude, you just did it again. I ain't even settled in yet, bro.
You can't even be confined, right?
Right. And other people's stuff got busted in this. You know what I'm saying? So I don't know. I ain't figured nothing out. So, but he ended up getting out of the hole. And where he worked at, his supervisor was so cool with him, he used to let me and my brother come down there. So me, my brother, and him would be all in the same room. And we was in there talking one day, and he was talking about the girl that he was dealing with at one point in time when we was younger. He was talking about all the stuff he used to do for her daughter. And I could remember getting so heated. And I went off, and I called the woman out of her name. I called the little girl out of her name. I said, man, I don't want to hear none of that. Because I'm really looking at you like you played a major role in the path me and my brother went down to even be in here with you.
Yeah.
And you talking about it. And then on top of that, bro, I used to watch so many people pay him respect in prison. Like, man, your daddy sold this and your daddy that, and he done helped me do this and counseled me and helped me do, and it used to anger me. And when he did that day, it came out. And he thought me and my brother was about to jump him. But my brother wasn't. He was shaking. He didn't want to really do it. We would have done it too. But initially, man, I wanted to get out everything I felt. I wanted to get that opportunity to express myself. I really wanted to say what's been on my mind, what's been on my heart for a long time. And I really, because I can be gunshot, I'm not one who waiting for the perfect opportunity. I'm gonna think about it once or twice, and then I'm gonna feel like I need to get this off of me. Mm-hmm. Whether we resolve it or not, I'm gonna get it up off of me.
Yeah.
And that was crazy because when that happened, they moved him to another prison right after that. So it took me another 2 years before the relationship became what it is today, which is beautiful.
Because you followed him to that prison?
He got me moved again. It got me moved again.
6 months from now, you could be running a 5K, booking that dream trip, or seeing thicker, fuller hair every time you look in the mirror. Through Hers, you can get dermatologist-trusted, clinically proven prescriptions with ingredients that go beyond what over-the-counter products offer. Whether you prefer oral or topical treatments, Hers has you covered. Getting started is simple. Just fill out an intake form online, and a licensed provider will recommend a customized plan just for you. The best part? Everything is 100% online. If prescribed, your treatment ships right to your door. No pharmacy trips, no waiting rooms, and no insurance headaches. Plus, treatments start at just $35 a month. Start your initial free online visit today at forhers.com/talk. That's forhers.com/talk. Tantande products are not FDA approved or verified for safety, effectiveness, or quality. Prescription required. Price varies both on product and subscription plan. See website for full details, restrictions, and important safety information.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
Get over here.
Literally, he got me moved again, man. And our relationship got better because I had a moment again of expressing how I felt. But we had spent about a month together in the cell. But it always felt like an elephant in the room to me because we were just, it was just routine. We were just, you know.
Small talk.
Yeah. Cellmates.
Yeah.
Really. But I knew this my daddy. And we got into it about the phone because we had a cell phone and I was in another cell talking to my daughter and the girl he was talking to at the time he was going with was calling the phone and I'm saying to myself, I just take him the phone when I get off the phone with my daughter. I ain't answer it. So I get out the phone and it's crazy talking like this, like a cell phone.
Yup, it's living a life.
Literally. So I come out of the cell and I'm going up in the cell and I give him the phone. I leave out. I go to play chess or whatever I was doing. And it wasn't 5 minutes. He came out of the cell and he called my name. He was like, boo. And in prison, certain tones are already going to trigger you.
Yeah.
Regardless of who it is. And when he said that, I remember thinking, who are you talking to? You ain't never been in my life. I ain't even want to entertain it. But he said, boo. And I turned around, he said, come here. And everybody kind of looking like I was in trouble.
Yeah, right.
Right. So I go up to the cell, bro, and go in, and he's standing up. And he was like, next time she called my phone, bring me my phone.
You don't say.
Listen, I just kind of looked at him and was like, what you say? And he repeated it. I took my shoes out and put my Timberlands on. I said, man, what's up? What you want to do? And like, I was literally like, he was like, what you want to do? Fight me? I said, man, you ain't got no choice. I was like, man, I don't know who you think. And I kind of started talking about my mama. Your side of the family ain't did nothing when you talking about your absence. Now, my uncle gave us money here and there, you know. I know we could go to him, but your absence, nothing can fill that in.
Yeah.
My auntie took us to see you here and there, but your absence, nothing can fill that in, bro. And I'm listening to you. I'm listening. I remember the conversation of the last girl you was dealing with and her daughter. We're talking about a whole different woman now. I was on the phone with your grandbaby. Told you that. You knew. You allowed this woman to go out saying why you didn't answer the phone and this, this, and that, or why he didn't, whatever was said. You went off on me. I'm your blood.
Mm-hmm.
We ain't even rectified and mended things that I feel or I'm thinking. You ain't even asked. And you chastising me. And the phone is sitting on the bed on. He chastised me in front of her.
She's still on the phone.
Yes. So at that point, and he like, man, we going back and forth. And then at that point, he tell me, basically like he finna ground me from using the phone. He was like, I tell you what, you can't use the phone. And where he had the phone that he telling me, you know, dang, I know where he had it, but they ain't gonna let me use. Man, I went over and tried to get that phone. He would not give me the phone. So I end up, and this is an older man. I end up roughing the old man up in the cell. We almost got to fighting. And he ended up telling my daddy. And this is where we ended up really having a legit heart-to-heart for the first time.
Mm.
He called me in the cell. He was like, boo, what's wrong with you? I was like, what you mean what's wrong with me? He was like, you done went over and put your hands on Tiny. I said, man, the reason I came to this prison because you promised me a phone. Now, because of whatever, you telling me I can't use the phone. And the other phone we got put up, you won't even give it to me. And then on top of that, I started explaining how I felt. And when I started explaining how I felt, he said, give me a second. He's like, step out of the cell. I said, no, I ain't going nowhere. And at that point, he turned his back on me. He was finna cry. And I walked up and I grabbed his shoulder and he jerked away from me. And when he turned around, he was crying. He started basically apologizing and saying he understand why if I don't love him and this, this, and that. And I was like, I do. And I was like, I'm hurt. Like, it's things I want to say. And it's things I'm sure that I feel you probably legit in saying too. And we hugged. Yeah. And from there, we started having more conversation of things of substance about each other.
Yeah.
And from there, bro, we done. That's my guy.
Yeah.
That's my guy, like, for real.
So you mentioned your daughter. Your daughter was born, assumption, maybe it's obvious, before you went to prison?
My daughter was 3. Yeah, she was born before I went to prison. My daughter was 3 when I went in. 3 or 4, yeah.
And how old? She was 13 when you came out?
Let me see. I want to, yeah, 13, 14, if I remember right. Yeah, I've been out, I'm going on 8 years. So, yeah, she's 21 now. Yeah.
So, given your experience and your anger, your disdain for your father for not being there, has your daughter forgiven you? Like, was that, did you find yourself apologizing to her?
Over and over. My baby, man, and our relationship is great right now. It's become great. I was prepared to take whatever because I was conscious of what me and my daddy went through. So whatever resistance or reservation she had, I was already prepared for it, which was painful because we did go through moments where I felt she felt entitled to things and felt like I didn't have, I ain't gonna say a say-so, but like, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew, and I also was careful because I didn't want to disrespect the respect she has for her mama. And that's hard to do when you're trying to find a balance because you got to be mature to not point the finger and make somebody else try to look at something else. Mm-hmm. So it was hard to take it on the chin. So the best thing I could do was just over time, just become the person I was asking my daddy to be, even though I was in that cell and he wasn't. So I just tried to play it like that. And over time we had some bumps here and there, especially when I had to say no about things where, because even though I had to forgive myself even in that, because I did a lot of things out of guilt initially coming home because of the time that I missed. And I started being vocal about that to her and her mama, because me and her mama had bumped heads a few times with me telling Samara, you know. And I'm telling her, like, regardless if I got it or not, like, and then I don't want her to have a man to where she feel like everything she say should go. You know what I'm saying? That man got to be a lead. I got to be a lead in my daughter's life. The opportunity that I have now, I missed it.
Mm-hmm.
And over time, like, we become, like, that's my baby, man. She's 21 now. She's doing great.
Wow.
Got a car. She working. She paying her own bills. Like, she got a head on her shoulders, man. And she called now, man. We chop it up like I don't say friends. I'm still a parent first, but
yeah,
we had a conversation. Like, so that's, yeah. And it was tough. It was most definitely tough. It was times I couldn't look her in the eyes.
Mm-hmm.
And she'll never know. She'll never know, because I remember my first year or two home not being able to really celebrate her birthday for the way I wanted to. I was trying to get myself together. I remember that pressure. And now being able to be there. Of course, a lot of times as a father, man, you have to realize that being a parent is 10 times bigger than just being there financially. Like, you really have to show them a way of life. You have to really be a demonstration of, for your daughters or for your boys, like, what it looks like.
Yeah.
And if you don't put that in the forefront, you'll lose yourself in a relationship with your children. And a lot of times in the beginning, I most definitely felt like the money was going to keep the Band-Aid on the wound. I was buying love. And then I started realizing, man, I want a genuine relationship with my daughter. I don't want to feel pressured like I'm doing this or she's only really talking to me because of the money. And that was before any kind of success as far as social media. But yeah. Me and my baby, man, we thank God for that.
Yeah.
So that's at the end of the day.
I have a 21-year-old too, so I get raising, people say raising or rearing.
Mm-hmm.
The relationship with an adult child is is very different, or should be. Mm-hmm. And I've had some challenges navigating that because she's still in the house.
Mm-hmm.
And now she has a daughter.
Mm-hmm.
So we have three generations in mm-hmm. the house, mm-hmm. which I've never been accustomed to. And we also have four other children that are younger than her. So how we handle her sets the tone for what they believe they can do, get away with, or should be entitled to. So I mm-hmm. get all of that. When you referenced, you mentioned that you got into the word in prison.
Mm-hmm.
How and what did that do for you?
Changed my life. I was going off on my third time parole. First time I went up, they hit me for 3 years. Second time, they hit me for two. And this third time I'm getting ready to go up, I got like 2.5 years left, I think. And I'm thinking, they going to let me out. They want me on some paper. Like, and I went up. And at this time, I'm in the church. I'm in the word. I'm doing...
In prison.
Mm-hmm. I'm doing gospel rap. Like, I'm really involved in the ministry. Like, seriously. But in that, like, I guess you could say being a babe in Christ, I felt entitled. I felt like he's supposed to do this because I'm doing this, and this.
Mm.
And that man... I wasn't in there 30 seconds, and he told me to do the remainder of the balance. And at that time, I'm in the second worst prison in the state with my uncle. And it was the longest walk back. The walk really only about 3.5, maybe 4 minutes. It felt like it took 2 days because I was so heavy, burdening. I wasn't angry at God at the time, but somewhat in a little sense I was. I was like, man, I've been doing everything, bro. Like, what I got to do the rest? Like, I'm ready to go, and I sit in the cell for 3 days. Only time I came out was just warm up my food or either go take a shower. And I remember my cellar, which is my spiritual advisor to this day, that's my guy, Dip, Columbia, Tennessee, Craig County. And he asked me, he said, what you going to do?
Mm.
I'm sitting on the top bunk, and he's sitting on the bottom bunk. He watching TV. I'm laying down. And I said, man, I'm going to write a book. And he kind of sniggled. Because most people, when they go through these epiphanies in prison, that's what they want to write a book. They're going to do this. They're going to do that. And then I said, man, hand me my tablet. And he raised up, hand me a pen, and he handed me my pencil. I turned on my little lamp, and I started writing right then and there. I wrote my first book in like 10 days, probably less, like just nonstop. But I call that moment, God tricked me. Because even though I was studying where I was getting some understanding, but not a lot. But this point, it broke me to the point where I was hungry. And it was certain things I was writing in the book concerning the characters. My cellie was tight on the word. I would ask him, what's a good scripture that'll go for this, the scenario that's going on right now? And I was really talking to myself because I wanted answers that I didn't. And he would be like, oh, that scripture right there, go look at such and such. It say, when a man ways please the Most High, he'll make even his enemies at peace with him. And I was, that'll fit. But I would open the Bible up and I would look at him. I would remember the scripture and I'd be like, this time it was getting in my system. I was like, I really need this. I'm finna get ready to go home. I look like I need this to apply in my life.
Right.
And I started getting hungry for more. The pages started popping off. The Bible had became so colorful to me.
Yeah.
And it became so important as something that I had been around all my life as far as church folks and religion and going to the church and my mama having a Bible on her nightstand, never seen her crack it open. I have never had nobody in my entire life pray over me openly when I was free. I have never, out of all these people who saw me in and out of trouble, I never had somebody say, give me your hands and pray with me right on the spot. It was like, I'm praying for you. I'm this, this, and that. The first time ever somebody prayed for me was in a cell, which was my uncle. He was like, man, we finna pray. And when he said it, no exaggeration, I was standing there like, all right, what we doing? What's the procedure? He had his hands out. He was like, give me your hands. Like, I was like, and it didn't feel like I was being masculine and in doing it. Like, it was so crazy, bro. And I put my hands in his hands and he started praying. It wasn't just a prayer. It was hearing him say these things that really brought me. It was bittersweet because I was like, I ain't never heard nobody do this. I ain't never heard nobody speak this life into me. I ain't never hear nobody quote these scriptures like that. I ain't never, and I remember, I was like, and when, and he hugged me after, and I was like, I ain't never experienced that. Never. And I've never been able to do it for nobody. I was like, I want to do that.
Yeah.
So by the time I'm writing this book and he giving me all these scriptures, man, it kind of, I was like, this is the word pretty dope.
Yeah.
And I was like,
the word is a movie.
Yeah. I said, man, this is beautiful right here. And then yeah. I started doing the music. So, yeah, that's how I started getting into the word, man. And,
I'm going through the book of Isaiah now, just as an aside. And that thing is why I hit my dad's like, Isaiah is wild. And after I sent the text, I'm like, does he even understand what I'm saying?
Yeah.
He's like a taste of what God had to deal with back then. And what he won't tolerate now. Like,
right. Right.
Yeah. That part.
Right.
So let's jump to the positive outcome mm-hmm. of all of this.
Mm-hmm.
And the story is far from over,
mm-hmm.
but you wrote that book.
Mm-hmm.
You wrote a book.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how many books you've written to date, but I know you've been successful with your books as a free man, taking advantage of social media, because we never went back to the social media piece. But let's talk about how you use your experience and how it's providing for you now.
Yeah. I wrote five. I wrote three in, and then I wrote two since I've been home. And coming home, when I walked out of prison, I had... My uncle always used to tell me, a lot of people ready to go home, they're not prepared.
We did an episode about ready versus prepared.
Yeah.
That's why I'm smiling.
And the first time he said, it kind of, I was like, Then he started saying it. And when I got separated from my uncle, I had almost a year left, and then it started registering. Like, because the time was getting close. It was really like, what you going to do other than go home, get a job, and you know what I'm saying? And I published my books while I was in the cell, and I sent them home to my mama, and I had 44 copies. That's all I could afford to get done, because I had quit hustling and doing everything else I was doing. And my mama sold them books in like 2-3 days. And when I called and told her, when I called and she told me, I remember feeling in my spirit right there, if I can get rid of 44 books with you sitting in the cell, what do you think I could do when you come home?
Mm.
So whether I sold another book or not from prison, I knew if that can happen in here, I can do way more. And my daddy had a phrase, because I ended up writing a book because of my daddy, because my daddy had wrote some books that I read. I read his book when I was in the cell with him. And he had a phrase he called it getting bit. You've been bit. And I believe that you can't overcome old information until you trump it with new knowledge. Only thing I have to rely on is what I know. My daddy also used to say, people continue to do what's working for them. So in order to transition into this new life, I need new experiences. I need new knowledge. I need new information to overshadow that.
Yeah.
So at that point, I was, what my daddy would call, I had got bit. I realized it was something else I can do other than selling dope and taking from people. And so social media was becoming a big thing while I was there. And mm-hmm. of course I had a phone, so I kind of played around with it a little bit. So by the time I came home, I was like an immigrant who come to America. I wasn't taking anything for granted. I realized that I had another opportunity at life when I deserved a life sentence. I should be in prison right now, not just for the situation we got caught for, but for all the things that I had done.
Yeah.
I should be doing life. So me taking it as God seemed fit to give me another opportunity, I will not waste this opportunity. And one thing with that is not just making sure I mend relationships to the best of my ability, being a father that I'm supposed to be, as far as mending my relationship having my relationship with my mother better, or being who I need to be in the community. I look at all of that as this is an opportunity to do all those things, not only become successful, the financial end. And the financial end was really just the icing on the cake to me, because he said, seek ye first his kingdom and his righteousness, and all things will be added unto you.
Mm-hmm.
If I'm doing what he asked me to do, I've just watched these things really add on to me. But I had to learn social media savvy, what I needed to do, how I needed to do it, paying attention to my comment section to tweak what I needed to tweak. But it's a vessel that I feel, I can't remember her name. I'm going to get it because she the one who told me. I was doing social media, but I wasn't on TikTok. And I went and got this job after I left a relationship that I was in for 2 years that God had been telling me to, you know, to break away from. Mm-hmm. And I was at this job and this girl kept telling me, you need to download TikTok. You need to. And I'm like, man, I'm not getting on. Like, people dancing. The second time she told me, she took my phone, downloaded it, the app. She was like, just get on there. And I looked at her. I'm like, man, I can't do that. I ain't doing that. The third time, she was like, just upload a video. And I try to make sure I'm listening at time. I'm like, let me. So I just uploaded some videos I had in my phone. I get 400-500 views. I was like, it ain't. And then she saw me again. She was like, no, you need to tell your story. I was like, I'm going to try it. And I'm sitting in my sister's house in the bedroom. And I recorded the first story. And before that, I was going city to city at malls. I'm probably averaging about 30, 40 book sales a week or so. Man, I recorded this, laid down, took a nap before going to work. I woke up and I sold 250 books.
From the store?
Yeah. I got up and kept going. I started selling 1,000 books a month. And that took 2.5, almost 3 years before that happened. But a lot of that I feel like happened because of her and the obedience of walking away from something he was saying. But that's kind of had how it started. Sustaining it is work. But I make sure to work. I do my best to try to make sure the work is centered in him. Because when I started making legal money, bro, it was an adjustment because I've always just, if the dope ain't, I'll take 28, turn it to 35, add an extra quarter. That's extra money. If it slow down, I'll kick a dough. This right here is centered in him. I have to treat it different. You know what I'm saying? I really have to apply it different. I've had to keep learning to overcome that old information.
Yep.
Literally. So,
wow.
Yeah.
Hopefully this conversation did a portion of your story justice. I mean, I'm sure you got a biopic or something in the works at some point in your life. But I'm interested to know, like, how you are today and not in a, like, a routine sense of it. Survivor's remorse is kind of what I heard you talking about. You're out when you should be in.
Mm-hmm.
How do you manage that in dealing with yourself? And how do you prevent that from impacting how you treat others, how you let people in your life, how you let people stay in your life?
That's
like,
real.
The things that seem to be more permanent because of who you are today when things were more transactional, as you mentioned,
right?
The majority of your life.
First and foremost, boundaries. Boundaries, and they hard to do depending on who they are. But boundaries and standing on principles will most definitely do more exposure than it'll do more help than harm, because it'll expose how they feel about you and how, because what you allow is what you're teaching a person how to treat you.
Yep.
And if I've set a tone, a new tone, made it clear that I want to be treated the way I'm treating you, I respect reciprocity. But to balance it all, really, I told my spiritual advisor a couple of days ago, I trust the thorn. When Paul said, remove that thorn, he said, my grace is sufficient. When I'm weak, his strength is made perfect. I rely on the thorn. That humility, I love it. When I feel like I'm okay with the thorn, it keeps me at his throne. And with that, that's really my thing. Like, when I could be feeling insecure when it come to, because I've always had hair, I could be feeling insecure when it come to my bald head now. And it's okay, because I still rely on the thorn in that insecurity. I have to trust him. Sometimes my girl asked me, well, my fiance asked me before coming here. She was like, you nervous? I'm like, yeah. Because sometimes I still Like, I'm human. Like, I'm, she was like, you'll be all right. Even in that, I say a prayer, come to him. I trust him. Like, social media, there's sometimes there's a, can I keep doing this? Or if I keep doing this, is it, I'm answering all kinds of things. And I'm like, man, that's a thorn. Like, but it's cool. My strength, his strength is made perfect. And all my weaknesses, I trust that thorn.
That's, I needed to hear that, bro, because I had that conversation with my dad probably toward the end of last year, all 2024, and today to some extent. Like, I've been having medical challenges that can't be explained, haven't been explained yet. So it's a lot of exploratory, go get this test, figure this out, or deduce, like, it's not this, was, let's see what the remainder says. And I asked him, I said, is this just my thorn? And, he said, I don't think so. He said, God is all-knowing, all-powerful, and he has the power to heal. He said, if anything, it may be that for now, but maybe not forever. So that was interesting to you. Yeah. My big Christian family.
Yeah. Like,
the trouble I got into nowhere near doesn't hold a candle to your story, and that's not celebrating it by any sense.
Yeah.
Any stint. But I did my dumb stuff, and thank God that we weren't in the social media era, and didn't get... We're not paying for all the things that we've done.
Right.
There's a beauty in that to some. What do you want the people to know about you if anything wasn't clear as we wrap?
I'm human. Ministry first is my life. When it comes to tradition and religion and the way we grew up seeing the way church is supposed to be done. I see a lot of people tell me a lot of times that, and I just want to say this to somebody who's trying to figure out what their calling is, and but if you're in your mind wondering how it should look a way you've seen it look all your life. When it comes to the pastoral role, being a shepherd, a lot of people say you automatically supposed to be behind the pulpit. Well, this is how I had a guy jump in my comment section. For the first time, I responded to somebody who I always be saying, you missing your calling. And I responded and said, I'm in it. And I had to stand up and say it because sometimes people force the way your calling should look on you. I trust him. Back to the thorn. Sometimes on social media, I cut up and I do what I do. But I'm blessed in doing so at the same time because there are a lot of pastors and bishops and deacons and first ladies who got to hide who they are and what they really struggle with because they're trying to convince the community of believers that they're strong and they doing this and not flawed and not falling short or thinking certain things or, you know, and I just want people to know I'm human and his hand is on me in my imperfection, not saying we as believers can abuse grace, but pay attention to the sanctification process because it's to remove the power and growth of sin. It doesn't mean the minute I became a believer, I was everything in your mind you saying a believer is supposed to be and how they should be.
Right.
So when you see me cut up sometime, that don't mean he removed his hand from me. I'm in the calling. You have to pay attention to the fruit. So if you're struggling with that, because I struggle with it, that's what I want people to know about me. I'm in the calling. I'm in the thick of it. The way, the authentic way I know he designed for me to be. I ain't being controlled or being told how I supposed to look as a believer and what I'm supposed to say and how I'm supposed to say it. And if you're dealing with that, then you're really being disobedient because you're trying to mimic something or and not allowing him to be in his fullness in who you are and how it should be. And that's why I want people to know about me. I'm in the fullness of who he is allowing me to be while doing ministry. And it's been a blessing to me because I can be vulnerable at any point. I can tell you what and how and when and I lay down because he said, don't be afraid of the person who can destroy the body, but him who can destroy the soul and the body. He has the heaven or hell to put me in and I live free. He said, whoever's in him is, he said, there's liberty. And I literally have that in such a beautiful way. And I just want people to know, when you see me cut up, I'm still his.
Hey, you ain't got nowhere to put him.
They got nowhere to literally put him. Yeah, work out your own salvation with fear and trembling for sure.
Traps on Tubi.
Traps is on Tubi, man. And I try to, the social media is beautiful. A lot of times people get caught up in the social media of what they think of people and how they, and I love the social media, it's allowing me, but I don't want people to look at me as that's a social media, such and such, such and such. Man, he said, let your light shine so that they may glorify him who is in heaven. If you're at my platform, I want you to see him. But my Instagram is Baker, III. And if you type in Joe T. Baker, everything else will pop up. Facebook, YouTube, TikTok, everything else will pop up if you type in my name. But yeah, it, Traps is on Tubi, and we're doing a movie right now called 21 Days. And mark my words when I say this, we're about to shock the world. The message is going to be extremely powerful.
Heard it here first, folks. Man, this is a good one. I appreciate you, brother.
Anytime.
I'm going to hold you to that.
Yeah.
Because you got the movie coming out. I want to, some other things we can discuss as well. Because what we discussed before camera, and even before this, is how you motivated me to get out of my head.
Yeah.
Because I'm sitting here with these cameras and access to studios and more cameras and equipment and all these ideas. Some are God-given, some are not.
Yeah.
But I think there's some purpose to be explored. You helped me with that unknowingly. Well, you know it now. So that's going to do it for this episode. We appreciate you guys. God bless you. Peace.
Months from now, you could be running a 5K, booking that dream trip, or seeing thicker, fuller hair every time you look in the mirror. Through Hers, you can get dermatologist-trusted, clinically proven prescriptions with ingredients that go beyond what over-the-counter products offer. Whether you prefer oral or topical treatments, Hers has you covered. Getting started is simple. Just fill out an intake form online, and a licensed provider will recommend a customized plan just for you. The best part? Everything is 100% online. If prescribed, your treatment ships right to your door. No pharmacy trips, no waiting rooms, and no insurance headaches. Plus, treatments start at just $35 a month. Start your initial free online visit today at forhers.com/talk. That's forhers.com/talk. Compounded products are not FDA approved or verified for safety, effectiveness, or quality. Prescription required. Price varies both on product and subscription plan. See website for full details, restrictions, and important safety information.
6 months from now, you could be running a 5K, booking that dream trip, or seeing thicker, fuller hair every time you look in the mirror. Through Hers, you can get dermatologist-trusted, clinically proven prescriptions with ingredients that go beyond what over-the-counter products offer. Whether you prefer oral or topical treatments, Hers has you covered. Getting started is simple. Just fill out an intake form online, and a licensed provider will recommend a customized plan just for you. The best part? Everything is 100% online. If prescribed, your treatment ships right to your door. No pharmacy trips, no waiting rooms, and no insurance headaches. Plus, treatments start at just $35 a month. Start your initial free online visit today at forhers.com/listen. That's forhers.com/listen. Compounded products are not FDA approved or verified for safety, effectiveness, or quality. Prescription required. Price varies based on product and subscription plan. See website for full details, restrictions, and important safety information.